Hello everyone, and welcome to CrownSearch, clinical research appraisal and methodology for surgical trainees, where we pick a paper fresh from the press on a hot general surgical topic. We review it for you, we present it for you, we critique its methodology for you, and provide top-of-the-field expert opinion and teaching on research appraisal and methodology. My name is Gio Perrin, and together with Professor Sababala Subramanian and Maria Digby, we bring you CrownSearch from the wonderful region of the Yorkshire and the Humber. Welcome back, everyone. Today we are going to have a discussion about a paper on the use of polyhexanide irrigation following laparotomy for GI surgery. Following that, we will have a brief chat about multiple arms randomized control trials. I'll leave you to it.
So hello and welcome, everybody. Obviously, my name is Fergus, and I'm presenting with Gio today. So the paper we're looking at is intraoperative wound irrigation for the prevention of surgical site infection after laparotomy, also known as the Iwisi trial. This was a randomized clinical trial by the CHIRNet in Germany by Muletici et al. So it was published in the JAMA Surgery 2024, and the PubMed ID and the link are down below for you.
Right, let's have a quick whiz through some background. Now, we do know that SSIs are an incredibly common problem in surgery and GI surgery particularly. If you look at colorectal trials on infection prevention, we do know that they happen very commonly, 15 to 30% of patients will get affected of some form of SSIs. They prolong hospital stay, increase cost, they add morbidity and to a degree mortality as well. The vast majority of risk factors for surgical site infections are non-modifiable, really, or hardly modifiable, certainly in emergency patients. So we all the time wonder whether simple interventions like wound irrigation could help. And in this particular case, we're talking about Prontosan, a very commonly used disinfectant solution in a variety of settings, including disinfecting babies' bottles. So hopefully this trial will tell us a bit more about that. And I'll pass the ball back to Fergus for a bit more about this study.
So the clinical question was, is prophylactic intraoperative wound irrigation with polyhexanide solution effective in reducing surgical site infections after laparotomy? So in a PICO format, the population was patients undergoing elective and emergency visceral laparotomy. This was transverse or midline. The intervention was intraoperative wound irrigation with a litre of polyhexanide solution. The comparator was either a litre of saline or no irrigation, and the outcomes were the incidence of surgical site infection within 30 days postoperatively. Just in terms of the exclusion criteria, there were quite a few. So these were the level of contamination, so level of contamination one, laparoscopic or robotic surgery, and surgery without opening the abdominal cavity. They also included revision surgery as well. So they also excluded anyone who'd had perioperative antibiotic therapy for 5 days before surgery. Those were ASA3 and those with severe immunocompromised, who were severely immunocompromised and who'd had chemotherapy within the last 2 weeks. Neutropenic patients, those with liver cirrhosis and pregnant or breastfeeding patients were excluded, as well as those who were allergic to polyhexanide. Back over to you, Gio.
Wonderful. So let's have a quick whiz through the methods. So this is what the author described as a prospective observer and patient blinded multicenter randomized control trial with three parallel comparison groups. Patients that are eligible for the trial gets randomized to either no irrigation, irrigation with saline, or irrigation with polyhexanide. And the distribution ratio is 1:3:3. The design is superiority with an attempt at demonstrating particularly polyhexanide superiority. And the expected difference that the authors use to do their sample size calculations is 2.2% for polyhexanide, 8.7% for saline, 16.2% for no irrigation. And I am sure that most people that have done surgery and have done wound irrigation realize that most of these numbers are fairly unrealistic to start with. But we'll talk about it in more details later. 12 surgical sites were involved in a surgical trial network in Germany, and the study was conducted between September 2017 and December 2021. Ball back to Fergus for a bit more about the methods.
So the primary efficacy endpoint was the incidence of surgical site infection within 30 days postoperatively, and the secondary endpoints were also assessed within that 30-day period. These were the length of stay in hospital, the reoperation rate, non-infectious wound complication rate, adverse events and serious adverse event rate, and mortality and morbidity. In terms of the randomization of the trial, a member of the study group who wasn't involved in the postoperative evaluation of patients performed intraoperative randomization after complete abdominal fascia closure. And this was done with an online randomization tool using predefined randomization lists. To ensure balanced group sizes, they also use blockwise randomization, and the allocation sequence was concealed to study group members who were performing the randomization. The blinding procedure was restricted to participants, outcome assessors, and the trial statistician. So the blinding of the surgical team performing the intervention wasn't possible, as one of the control arms didn't receive any wound irrigation. And then for the post-op follow-up, blinded investigators were conducted the assessment of the primary endpoint.
Right, let's have a quick look about the results. So let's start with some baseline characteristics. Now, I've cut out some that are relatively irrelevant, such as demographics. They're pretty much spread out throughout the groups and pretty much what you would expect from an average general surgical population. I've focused on some particular risk factors for wound infections, such as BMI. As you can see, the groups of BMIs are fairly well equally spread across the three groups. And if you look at smoking status as well, and we do have some characteristics about the procedure itself, Fergus. Yeah. The NNIS risk score, which is a score that's used to calculate the risk of surgical site infection. It's, again, equally spread across the groups, and level of contamination according to WHO classification is also pretty well spread. It's a couple of things are worth noting here. First of all, the predominant group is grade 2. And interestingly enough, there are some grade 1, which if you do remember, it's only 2 by all means, but if you do remember, those were exclusion criteria. So level of contamination 1 was not supposed to be included in the trial at all. Ball back to you, Fergus, for more results.
So sort of this is a nice diagram, again, which sort of a nice flow diagram of the randomization of the trial. In total, 11,700 patients were assessed for eligibility and 689 were randomized, and they were randomized equally in that 3-to-3-to-1 ratio. I think the main thing to note here, I won't bore you by going through the entire flowchart, is the dropout rate, which I think they state in the paper that they were surprised by how high it was. And I think at nearly 20%, it's a pretty significant number.
Excellent. So let's have a look at the primary results. So as you can see, there is no statistically significant difference between the three groups, polyhexanide, saline, or no irrigation. And also, it's worth noting that the incidence of wound infections is significantly higher than what they would expect, particularly for polyhexanide. They expected about 2-2.5% is nearly four or five folds that. And if you then look at the type of surgical site infection, again, this is classified based on the WHO classification. So superficial, deep, and organ space, where deep is basically deeper layers of the wound. And as you can see, they're fairly equally spread across the three groups. So there really doesn't seem to be any statistically significant or clinically significant difference between polyhexanide, saline, or no irrigation. Ball to you, Fergus.
So in terms of the secondary outcomes, similarly to the primary outcomes, all the percentages across polyhexanide, saline, and no irrigation remain very similar in terms of sort of all the secondary outcomes they looked at. And again, it demonstrated no statistical difference across those groups. So in terms of the limitations of the study, the self-reported limitations were, as we discussed earlier, that they couldn't they had the no irrigation control arm. Another limitation here is that polyhexanide is currently not approved for intraperitoneal irrigation, therefore it could only be used after the fascia had been closed. They also note that polyhexanide requires a tissue contact time of at least 10 minutes to take full effect. And one of the limitations they reported here is that, you know, I think we've all been there at the end of a busy day with a long case. They were concerned that people might not have waited the full 10 minutes whilst closing up. As previously mentioned as well, the number of dropouts was twice as high as anticipated in the planning stage of the trial. And they also note that management of post-op complications varied among participating centres, so in terms of either sort of conservative management or relaparotomy, for example.
Right, let's have a quick look at a few other things that we picked up. Now, had not had a dissecting eye through their study protocol, which they published back in 2017, but I couldn't really, reading through the paper, fully understand the rationale of adding a saline washout arm. So why complicate your life when you could just do a comparison between no irrigation and polyhexanide? The sample size calculations were performed according to a expected 2.2% or 2.3% incidence of wound infection in the polyhexanide group. This, interestingly, is coming from a relatively small study on soft tissue traumatic wounds. And it's worth noting that there is data that predates this trial that actually suggests a much higher infection rate, particularly in laparotomy patients. And you can see a reference there at the bottom. This study was the POLIS trial that I'm talking about now, specifically looked at respecting the 10 minutes contact time for polyhexanide or simply washing it out earlier. And the authors of that particular trial did not record any difference. So really, even if the polyhexanide was left for less than 10 minutes, that shouldn't have made a difference to the results of this trial. Interestingly, in both groups, long or short exposure, the SSI rate after midline laparotomy was quite high, 18-20%, higher than what's been reported in this study as well. I'm not entirely sure why they a priori cut out colorectal extraction sites from this. I do appreciate they want to make this as sort of real life as possible, but ultimately we do perform a mini laparotomy, particularly for right-sided resections, to extract our specimens, and we do often encounter wound infections in those cases. So perhaps, especially if there's an extracorporeal anastomosis, so perhaps it would have been a more pragmatic to actually include them. Modality of administration is something that is open for debate. Certainly, there is some evidence to suggest that pulsing a wound washout is more effective than soaking, and these authors use soaking. I am not entirely sure that this sample is representative of the general population. Now, I don't know how much colorectal surgery performed open or laparoscopic in Germany. If you look at results of a relatively recent, very large cohort study, the Resectat study on a complete mesocolic excision, and I'll give you that this is a subgroup of colorectal patients, but certainly in that study, 75% of colorectal cases were performed open. So I'm pondering why so little colorectal was actually in this study. The study is probably underpowered because the difference they detected between the three arms is not really there in terms of absolute crude number. And two patients were not meeting the inclusion criteria, which we felt perhaps should have been excluded after randomization. I finished with that. So I'll pass it back on to Fergus for some bottom line.
So to conclude, the bottom line is that sort of on the basis of the results that they presented in the trial, intraoperative wound irrigation with polyhexanide cannot be recommended as a standard clinical practice in open, clean, contaminated vesical surgical procedures. And there is a sort of bit of a table to sum up down below there, which sort of goes through everything we've talked about. So thank you all very much.
As usual, we discussed a few points following the presentation of the paper. First of all, we started by discussing the purpose of the 3-arm design and what the aim of the study was. As mentioned in the presentation, one aim might be to try and determine what is the best strategy between the three compared by the authors, or compare two different interventions versus a single control arm. And this does have important implications in terms of the way the results are presented, and we will discuss this further in the teaching presentation later. We then discussed the choice of the polyhexanide irrigation solution for this particular study. The authors do mention that NICE guidelines recommend no irrigation, as well as WHO and CDC recommending aqueous betadine. We were then asking ourselves why aqueous betadine was not used as either a comparator arm in a two-arm RCT or instead of saline in the context of a multi-arm RCT like this one. We reiterated again how sample size calculations are crucial in this type of trials, and how unexpected difference in favors of a particular treatment is a key element of such calculations. And we then discussed how these sample size calculations would differ if instead of using the assumed 2.2% SSI rate in the polyhexanide group, the authors had used what has been previously reported as up to 20% for abdominal surgery in polyhexanide. We finally had a brief chat about the use of pulsatile irrigation and the importance of mode of administration in irrigation of wounds in general, and how this adds an additional layer of complexity to the whole discourse around irrigation of wounds postoperatively. To conclude, we looked at the possibility of there being a degree of underpowerment in this study, and that perhaps there is a difference between polyhexanide, saline, and no irrigation. That difference might be quantifiable in around 1-2%. And we discussed why we would be willing to accept or not accept that this is clinically relevant, and whether we would start using polyhexanide. Given the statistical results of the trial, yes, the difference could possibly be there. However, it does seem to be not statistically significant. Therefore, the 2% difference might well be due to chance. Furthermore, there are some obstacles that relate to the nature of the solution itself, such as the inability to use this inside the abdomen, the possibility of inadvertent spillage, as well as the chance of causing an allergic reaction in a solution that is used relatively uncommonly in our clinical practice in the UK. I'll leave you to the teaching sessions. Enjoy.
So just a few words about multiple arms RCTs. I know it's late, so I'm not going to go crazy with theoretical explanations or things like that, but at least a brief introduction. So start with simple things. What is the definition of a multi-arm RCT? Plain and simply, it's a randomized controlled trial involving three or more treatment arms. And so far, it's all fairly simple. How common is it? Well, if you look at trial registries, 1 in 10, 2 in 10, depending on what year you consider, of the registered RCTs are actually multi-arm, and then becoming more and more common as more different types of treatments are available for a particular type of disease. And generally speaking, if you think about it, it is an RCT. And we have spoken about RCTs extensively in our journal club, and we've got a number of videos available on our website about it. And I'll send you back to chapter 3, 4, and 5, where we give you an introduction as well as all the details about randomizations and things. And all the points that are there on how to critique and how to appraise an RCT certainly do apply to multi-arm RCTs as well. But certainly there are some complicating factors. And as such, and as I mentioned during the presentation earlier on, whenever we are designing a multi-arm RCT or looking at a multi-arm RCT, certainly we need to have a very clear idea of why we are choosing this particular type of design. What is the purpose? Because there are different reasons to do it, and with different reasons comes slightly different designs and slightly different issues as well. So generally speaking, there's two reasons to do a multi-arm design. The first reason is clinical. There are a number of treatments available, And that is very common when you're talking about, for example, cancer treatment. You can provide a standard set of chemotherapy and add a drug or another drug or a monoclonal antibody, for example. And you might want to compare at the same time a number of different types of treatment. This becomes very important when there is also a logistical issue. The logistical issue might be the only reason to do a multi-arm trial. But basically, when you have a condition that is relatively rare or where it is very, very hard to recruit patients, you might want to try and combine two RCTs into one in order to accelerate your recruitment process and obtain results quicker. Often, it is a mixture of the two. Now, for the purposes of explaining differences between different types of multi-arms RCTs, I'm going to kind of split these two, if you like, reasons or indications, and give you some examples. Furthermore, it is also important to understand whether we're doing a multi-arm RCT for an exploratory reason, so to figure out a little bit of what's going on, or to confirm a hypothesis, that is to say, actually figuring out what works and what doesn't work. So let's start by the assumption that we have a condition where multiple treatments are available. And again, this is common in oncology. So whenever we are designing a trial like this or looking at a trial like this, we need to ask ourselves, are the treatment arms that we are including in our trial related? And we have to look at a clinical question to figure that out. And often, when there are multiple treatments available, yes, the treatment arms are actually related. And I'll give you an example. This is a diagram of a actually multi-arm, multi-stage trial, which is called STAMPEDE. And as you can see, the authors start with a number of different treatment options. The vast majority of them, actually all of them, include a basic standard of care bundle, plus other things. And the authors want to actually figure out what is the best treatment among all of them. And all these treatments are compared with each other. The one that we discussed today, the trial that we discussed today, to my eye, fits into this sort of type of design predominantly. And the vast majority of oncology multi-arm trials are fitting here. And again, I can't stress this enough, we've got a number of treatments and we want to figure out which one works best. That is comparing with the standard of care or just comparing a number of treatments with each other. Let's move on to a different type of reasons to do this trial, so logistics. Now, in this case, the treatment arms are not necessarily related to each other. And again, you've got to look at the research question to figure this out. What do I mean? I mean that for an opportunistic reason, there are two treatments that are available and they are separately tested versus a single control arm. But the control arm is recruited at the same time as for both treatments to compare with both treatments. So you have treatment A and treatment B. You compare treatment A versus placebo and treatment B versus placebo, for example. Or treatment A versus standard of care, treatment B versus standard of care. You're not comparing A versus B. That's the difference compared to the design we discussed earlier on. I'll give you a practical example, which I think is quite clever. So let's think about colorectal cancer. And let's think about advanced one. And we normally give patients that do have advanced colorectal cancer continuous chemotherapy with Oxcap, which is a combination of oxcalplatin and capecitabine. Now, in this context, you might have two questions in mind. What if we put in some cetuximab? And what if instead of giving continuous chemotherapy, we do intermittent chemotherapy? Does it work? We don't know. Now, the two questions are separate. The two completely different separate questions. One is about adding a drug. One is about changing the way you administer the drug. And this has been done in the MRC COIN trial. And generally speaking, when you have a trial that is designed this way, it's not just that the questions are separate, but also the results are presented separately. And that's what the author did, and they got two publications into the Lancet. One looking at cetuximab with oxaliplatin with Oxcap effectively versus Oxcap, and the other one is intermittent versus continuous treatment. And the authors do summarize this very well in this chart. So there's three arms, and again, I cannot stress this enough. The aims are comparing two different modes of administration, A versus C, or comparing A, standard of treatment, versus standard of treatment plus cetuximab. Two separate questions. But for convenience, the control arm is the same. So certainly, designing and conducting a trial like a trial which involves multi-arm does have a number of advantages. As we discussed, sample size reduction is a significant problem. And we do know, and we've discussed many times in this journal club, trials that just can't reach the number of patients that they needed to reach, or that take a very long time to do so. So certainly it's very attractive to have the option to just recruit one control arm and the number of different treatment arms. Recruitment is easier. And certainly, if you want to mathematically look at how much less you have to recruit, you can do that using this formula here. If you have a number of experimental agents that you want to try, your number of experimental agents minus one over two times the number of experimental agents is the amount of reduction you would get. And if you run the calculations with three experimental agents, you can run a multi-arm trial and you need to recruit 37% less patients than if you were to conduct six separate trials, which is obviously a big advantage. Certainly, if you do explore a number of different possibilities, you have higher chances of finding a positive result. And certainly, if you can get approval for one trial that looks at three experimental agents, that's a massive saving time and a massive saving paperwork, as well as going through ethical committees. Now, let's have a better look at the higher chance of finding a positive result. Looking at how fast recruitment is. Now, this is a chart that comes from an editorial that was published in The Lancet concomitantly with the Stampede trial, actually. And it illustrates very well how much easier it is to recruit patients into multi-arm trials. So look at trials that have two arms and how much they recruit. And look at three arms, how much they recruit. Look at six arms, how much they recruit. It is quite an impressive difference. And the argument that these authors make in their editorial is that actually patients find these trials more attractive. And they've been asked a couple of times, apparently these are authors from London, by patients, why don't you run all your trials like this? And hopefully I'll convince you of the why. So we talked about having a higher chance of a positive result, right? And again, coming from the same editorial, the chances of finding a positive result become really, really, really much higher the more arms you include. And if you look at this chart, particularly for this sort of level of correlation of treatment effect, you would think, wow, why don't we just do this all the time? Why would we even bother with two arms trials? Well, the issue is that, as we discussed before in this journal club, the more you test, the more likely you are to find a positive result. That is just by chance. It's called multiple statistical testing. And if you look at the number of tests that you can run on a data set, the chances of hitting a false discovery become significantly high, even for a relatively low number of tests. Now, obviously, this is a well-known phenomenon that has been discussed in the literature. And if you just do a quick Google search, you'll find a lot of papers talking about multiplicity issues and multiplicity adjustment. And basically what it is just a higher chance of finding a false positive result or a type one error. Things to consider when you're looking at a paper that talks about multi-arms is certainly what is the reason to conduct the study? Are you just exploring to figure out if there's a superior treatment that then you want to compare with your standard of care? That's an exploratory trial. By all means, in that case, it's relatively unimportant if there is a degree of type 1 error, although you still should try and avoid it. But if you're really looking to figure out what's the best treatment out there in a bunch, because that's what you want to give your patients, you really should be careful about it. And you really should make sure that we have accounted for multiplicity and we've done some adjustments. If the arms are distinct and you're just using one single control arm to compare two different types of treatment against it, probably multiplicity is less of an issue. And this is the example of the colorectal trial I mentioned earlier on. If the results are presented all together, like in the trial we discussed today in the journal club, certainly you need to make sure the multiplicity adjustment has been done. And the authors of the trial of polyhexanide certainly did do that. If multiple outcomes are considered all at the same time, again, you need to adjust for that. Multiple interim analyses also affect that, as well as repeated measures of the same outcome in time. And the more subgroups you've got, the more tests you run, the more likely you are to find a false result. So all these things are important to consider when you're reading a paper that talks about or describes a multi-arm intervention. And this comes from a paper from 2017 and kind of tries and make you consider when it is really important to consider multiplicity as an issue and as a source of false positive results. And certainly the enthusiasm of multi-arm trials that I've discussed earlier on needs to take that into account. So just a brief summary, some key points. Multi-arm RCTs ultimately are RCTs, and most appraisal points are the same. The rationale for choosing a design like this needs to be clear. Certainly look at the research question, because it does have important design repercussions that we discussed. There are numerous advantages, but there is also an important disadvantage, which is the high risk of a type 1 error. And certainly this has been picked up, and there are specific reporting guidelines for multi-arm parallel group RCTs published in very prominent journals such as JAMA. So that's something, if you guys are interested, you could look at. That's it.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in and listening. Until next time, keep priming your life with our surgical podcast.